Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today I want to pick up on the theme that we ended last week and didn't really have enough time to cover, especially since this past week we see the launching of the PR offensive by the Biden administration called Bidenomics. What is Bidenomics? And they're trying to spin it and peddle it as something different than Reaganomics and the policies of the last 40 years by both Republican and Democrat presidents, which is called neoliberal economics. As you know, I've written this book a couple of years ago, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, where I traced the origin of neoliberal economic policies from the late 90s up through Trump. Haven't applied that analysis yet to the Biden administration, but we'll do so once it becomes even clearer. And, of course, the smoke is clearing, and it's becoming clearer that Bidenomics is really the continuation of neoliberal economic policies. I started to talk about that last week, and I want to continue here and clarify that to some extent here in today's show. Okay, before doing that, just a brief comment about today's job numbers. Once again, 209,000 jobs created, as they say. Some important things to know about that. It takes about 100,000 jobs a month new entry into the labor force. In other words, you got to find work for 100,000 new people entering the labor force every month, and anything on top of that is net new gain. And of course, 209,000 means you got about 100,000 plus of quote net new jobs. 209,000 is a growth of the labor force. But, and once again, as I've said before, this number that we get every month is from one of the surveys of the Labor Department. It's called the current establishment survey, CES survey. This comes from large corporations who send the data. It's kind of like a census, not really a sample, to the Labor Department. And the Labor Department publishes this. And as I've said, there's a problem with the CES because it really only captures mostly full-time work and jobs. It doesn't really capture what we're losing on part-time temp gig jobs. And that comes from a different survey, the CPS, the current population survey, which is a sample of about 60,000 a month survey by the Labor Department of people, not from businesses, and the CPS picks up smaller businesses' situation. And it also picks up the information on part-time temp and so forth, even though it underestimates that, in my opinion. So you got to look at the one survey that reports full-time from large corporations and the other survey that includes part-time from smaller businesses. Two surveys that are often in contradiction. And the problem with the CES establishment survey is, as I've said before, it's really a statistic that takes these numbers given by the large employers and the Labor Department then adds to it this really questionable further statistic, which is called new business development. Now, the problem with that is the new business development is lagged 6 to 9 months. In other words, it's new businesses formed 6 to 9 months ago, added to the numbers the big corporations give to the Labor Department, and they slap those two sources together, and then they make adjustments to it for seasonality and so forth, and that's the number you get, the 209,000 that comes out. The problem with the new business development survey, as I said, is not only that it's lagged, but it's a measure of the assumption about how many employees are hired for a new business, which is kind of arbitrary and a long-term average. Yeah, it's the net number from new businesses created 6 to 9 months ago minus businesses that went out of business and thus unemployment, right? Well, the problem with that statistic is they know how many new businesses were formed because the business has to file with the state, Secretary of State, whatever, and says, oh, you know, you got to file a new business record. But they don't know how many businesses went out of businesses because when a company goes out of business, it doesn't file any reports with the state that it's no longer in business. So they have a totally arbitrary, fictitious number for the number of companies going out of business versus the number who are forming, and that net number is the number that they take, the Labor Department, and they smash together with the number given them by the large businesses, you see, and they come up with the 209,000 after additional statistical manipulation. So, you know, I don't have much trust in that particular number, 209,000 or whatever it is. I think more accurate might be the population survey, although there's problems with that as well. You know, you need to take all these numbers with a grain of salt. I think these numbers don't work very well post-COVID. But nonetheless, the Federal Reserve targets this number and says, oh, you know, the economy is growing too much here. You know, what we want is more unemployment, particularly in the services sector. We want more unemployment to bring wages down, as if wages are the cause of inflation, you see. And then the Labor Department says, oh, wages are rising too much, nominal wages, you know, they're still too high. Well, you got to break that down, and you'll find that among the higher paid 10% of the labor force, yeah, wages are rising. And maybe in some states that are passing higher minimum wage laws, so at the two ends of the wage structure, you get nominal wages maybe rising, but in between, you know, in the middle class, wages and even nominal are not rising. But the average is for everything, you see, for those who are getting increases, not for those who are in the middle. And the government doesn't keep statistics for those in the middle wage change. So the average looks like it's too high, but it's skewed to the top is the point. You know, and the Fed looks at that and says, oh, wages are rising too much, we need higher interest rates. And we need more unemployment in the services sector, because it's apparently services inflation that's the core now. They've brought down prices in the goods sector. In other words, manufacturing and construction, that's been brought down. So the inflation that exists in the services sector, by the way, the goods sector is in a very clear recession already. Manufacturing, the latest data, manufacturing is contracted again for the ninth month in a row in the U.S. So it's contracting, you know, chronically, steadily here. Construction is flat on its back. It has been. It's only at roughly two-thirds of what it was. That's not growing. So the goods sector, which is manufacturing and construction, is in deep recession already. And they're trying to create more of a recession in the services sector because the Fed thinks that wages are the problem. Right, we need more employment, so we get services sector wages down, and that will bring wages down. Well, you know, that whole approach ignores, it assumes that inflation is only caused by demand, therefore let's cut wage income and cut demand. It totally ignores the fact that there are supply-side problems that are driving inflation as well. A good example here, perhaps, is what's going on with OPEC Plus. OPEC is cutting the price of crude oil again, the supply, which is raising the price of oil, crude oil, and of course that all gets passed through, and it totally ignores. Fed totally ignores when it talks about cutting services wages. It totally also ignores the fact that a lot of the inflation in the U.S. is price gouging by corporations. Now they're calling that greedflation, right? Well, that's price gouging by another name. Well, who's price gouging? Companies and industries that have a high concentration of companies running the whole sector. You know, like 80% is run by three or four companies. Take bakery goods, for example, you know, bread and so forth. You look at that, well, three or four companies run that whole industry. Those prices are chronically high. And even some companies, I don't know if it's General Mills or one of the others, I'm not sure, Kellogg, I'm not sure, but it's bragging now that its record profits have been totally due to price increases. They're not selling more of this stuff. People aren't buying more bread, but their prices are going through the roof, and so are their profits. Well, that's price gouging, you see, and that's going on in multiple industries. And that's really a supply-side problem. And other supply-side problems are productivity is collapsing in this country, which brings unit labor costs up that get passed through. It's not that wages are rising, causing unit labor costs to rise dramatically. As I've indicated, it's mostly skewed to the top. It's productivity collapsing, which is collapsing the worst since productivity records were kept back in 1947. So what we got is a productivity problem, which means a lack of real investment problem in this country that would bring it up. So anyway, that's my commentary here on the latest job numbers. I've said it before. It's the same. It hasn't changed. And my commentary on the supply side causes of inflation that the Fed cannot address effectively. So the Fed is trying to take it all out on the backs of service workers by creating more services unemployment. It will keep raising rates until it generates a significant unemployment expansion in the services industry and takes it out on the back of service workers who, you know, in general, don't make the same salaries and wages, even nominal wages, that workers in construction and in manufacturing do. So they're the least able to deal with the unemployment. Okay, so that's my comment on the job numbers, and it leads to a segue to this topic I want to continue talking about today, which is we got this big PR offensive going. Apparently somebody in the White House has decided, oh, we got to tout more what we're doing here because, you know, we can make some pretty good arguments that, you know, economically we're doing okay. You know, they talk about the Biden administration has talked about all the jobs they've created, right? Well, those are jobs that are restored after COVID, not created. And those that are net created are mostly part-time temp gig work. Right? It's not full-time employment. Look at the CPS survey, and you see a general steady decline in full-time jobs in this country. You will see a growth in total jobs, which means people are working and being hired more part-time and temp basis, right? Or they're taking on second or third jobs because these job statistics are not about people working. They're about jobs created. So that if a person already working a part-time job takes a second or third job, well, you've got two more jobs created. It's job creation. It's not people employed. Okay, so that's just a continuing commentary on that jobs number here. But I want to get back to this PR offensive, Bidenomics. You know, they're saying, oh, you know, what I said, oh, job creation. And they're really touting these three acts legislative acts that have identified the policy of the Biden administration this past year. These acts are the Infrastructure Act, the Chip and Sciences Manufacturing Subsidy Act, and the so-called Inflation Reduction Act. These three acts amount to $1.65 trillion passed in 2022, late 21, 2022, right? Just about the time that they shit-canned the Build Back Better bill, which was all supposed to continue providing stimulus to households, you see. But they cut out the COVID relief, the one bill that Biden had passed there in March of 2021. They cut that off real quick. You know, that was the one that gave us some reduced checks. 10 million people got unemployment benefits, child care benefits, rent subsidies, and so forth, right? That was the COVID Relief Act. Biden cut it out early and transferred some of the money and then threw more money in the pot to finance these three fiscal investment spending bills, acts, that became acts, the three that I just mentioned, $1.65 trillion. What it means is they're shifting money from household relief to corporate subsidies, because a lot of these three acts, the $1.65 trillion, takes the form of tax cuts and subsidies for corporations. So they shifted the money, they moved it around and threw more in the pot for these investment bills. And investment means of government policy subsidizing. You know, the CHIP Act, the Science Act is a slush fund, really, to get U.S. companies to relocate from China and Asia back to the U.S. here, because semiconductors and chips are militarily strategic, right? So the U.S., that's planning a fight with China 10 years from now, wants to get these companies out of that area and bring them back to North America. I say North America because a lot of them will relocate to Mexico, not to the U.S., you see. Okay, so the CHIP and Science Act, I think it's like either $280 billion or $380 billion. It's really a slush fund, a subsidy to bribe and lure U.S. companies and foreign companies to the U.S. A big part of this money is going to be given to the Taiwan semiconductor company TSMC, biggest in the world, to relocate and build in the U.S., which it's doing. It's also luring European companies to relocate in the U.S. That's why Europe is all upset with some of these bills, because it means instead of investment in Europe, these companies are going to come to the U.S. to get the free money. Yeah, and the infrastructure bill is also heavily tax cut subsidy oriented, and the Inflation Reduction Act, misnamed, of course, is partially money to stimulate investment in alternative energy in the U.S., but also a lot of money going to the traditional fossil fuel companies, thanks to Joe Manchin, who runs the committee in the Senate that deals with energy investment. Okay, so bottom line, it's a big shift of money from households to corporations and investors. And it's not doing much for the real economy right now because it's longer term, you see, this $1.65 trillion. When they were giving relief to households, it was immediate, right? And that helped jumpstart the economy out of the COVID shutdown. But when you shift the money from that and you give it to corporations and investors, long-term investment-oriented, it takes time. That $1.65 trillion is really over 5 to 10 years, you see, so it's really not that much immediately. What I call a neoliberal fiscal policy, right? Subsidize businesses and investors and austerity for households. And, of course, we're getting austerity now, aren't we? That's what the debt ceiling bill was all about, which is just the start of austerity. You're going to see another iteration of that come this fall when the new budget is debated. So they'll take another bite out of that austerity apple here in a couple more months. And it will continue cutting programs here and there, social programs, and subsidizing businesses and helping finance the increased war spending, you know, which is also fiscal spending because the government subsidizes a lot of the war production companies, even though they're, you know, billion-dollar profit companies, many billion-dollar profit companies. But Bidenomics, you know, is being spun as, you know, it's not trickle-down. Oh, trickle-down economics was Ronald Reagan. Well, neoliberalism is trickle-down, and Bidenomics is just another stage of neoliberal policies. Last week I started and very quickly surveyed, a little too fast maybe, what the essence of neoliberal policies are. As I talked about in my book, Scourge of Neoliberalism, there are four basic policy sectors in neoliberalism: fiscal policy, monetary policy, industrial policy, and what's called trade or external policy, which deals with also with not just goods flows, but across the economies, but money flows, the dollar, etc. That's external policy. Those four areas define neoliberal policy. It's a certain kind of a mix of policies. The policies designed to subsidize domestically capitalism and capital at the expense of labor, and also designed to increase the hegemony and the strength of U.S. businesses abroad, the empire, the economic empire, you know, increase its hegemony globally. And if you look at those four areas, well, very clearly, there is a crisis in monetary policy, because monetary policy is about keeping interest rates low. Why do they like to keep interest rates low? Well, because it reduces the cost of businesses in general, but it's also what the U.S. multinational corporations like, because if the dollar is low, is cheap, the profits they make abroad in foreign currencies will buy them more dollars when they repatriate those profits abroad, back home. So low interest rates, I mean, low dollar, and that benefits U.S. multinational corporations, right? Also benefits exporters from the U.S. that don't relocate operations abroad. So neoliberal policy is low interest rates. Oh, but wait a minute, we got rising interest rates, don't we? Because we got rising inflation, you see. So the Fed is facing a contradiction. Does it raise interest rates and reverse neoliberal policy in order to control inflation? Or does it keep interest rates low here to benefit U.S. multinational corporations by keeping the dollar low? So, you know, it's a contradiction. Monetary policy is facing a major contradiction, and it's becoming less and less effective. Neoliberal monetary policy is now the weak link of neoliberal policy mix. Fiscal policy is more of an intermediate-term problem. Why intermediate? Well, because they keep running up these deficits, and the deficits run up the debt. You see, the debt, national debt, is just accumulation of annual deficits. And one of the hallmarks of neoliberalism is they don't care about budget deficits, you see. They will live with rising budget deficits. And the reason they live with budget deficits is because of all the foreign dollars that have been flowing offshore for 40 years due to a trade deficit. the U.S. runs. A lot of it gets recycled back to the U.S. And pays for the deficit. In other words, they use that money recycling back to the Treasury to fill the hole in the annual budget deficit that's caused by chronic, long-term, massive corporate tax cuts, and at the same time, accelerating U.S. Defense and war spending. You see, the tax cuts and the war spending caused the budget deficits, leaves a real shortfall, but the money coming back into the country to buy U.S. Treasuries fills up that hole, that shortfall hole, but not totally. The hole keeps growing, and that's what the annual deficits are, and that keeps added to the debt. So neoliberal policy is, in a nutshell, fiscal side policy is increase war spending and defense spending, increase subsidies to corporations and so forth, and at the same time, find ways to cut social program spending and spending on households, austerity, right? Of course, that creates a deficit, right? Because the cuts in social program spending cannot equal the increases in government tax cuts for corporations and investors and the war spending. The two can't offset each other. Reagan tried to do that, and it was called voodoo economics back then, and it still is, and they couldn't make it work, you see. Reagan, you know, the first iteration of neoliberal policy, fiscal policy in this country, created a big increase in war and defense spending, right? Big tax cuts for businesses, and they tried to offset that with social program cuts, but they can only do a small part of the huge increase. So deficits began to rise dramatically. When Reagan comes in office, the deficit is less than $1 trillion. Okay. By 2000, it's $6 trillion. By 2016, I think it was like $17 trillion. By 2022, it's $31-plus trillion. And it's still continuing to rise. With this debt ceiling bill, it's going to be about $33 trillion, maybe, at least more. And it's going to continue to rise for the rest of the decade. So neoliberal fiscal policy is tax policy, spending policy, and deficit debt policy. And the essence of neoliberal fiscal policy is very clear. Let's keep tax cuts for corporations and investors. Let's keep increasing war and defense spending. Let's try to introduce austerity and reduce spending on households. And let's do whatever we can to minimize, but not really balance the budget so that we have annual deficits, chronic continuing, and at the same time, national debt escalating. Well, that can't continue without a problem at some point, you know, because the deficits, the interest on the deficits and the national debt, you've got to pay interest on that debt. The government does, has to pay interest. Well, the interest costs are rising. I think the interest costs before 2020 was like $200-some billion a year. Last year it was $600 billion, and at minimum it's going to $900 billion here, in 3 or 4 more years. $900 billion, because interest rates are rising, you see. $900 billion has to be financed out of the budget every year. Well, how high can you keep going that interest on the debt payment without saying, what are we going to do? Can we continue cutting social programs? Well, we've cut discretionary social program spending to the bone already. The only place they can go now is after Social Security, Medicare, which is what they'll do. If we want to continue war spending, you know, for a planned war with China and this long-term chronic war over there in Ukraine with Russia, right, that's going to continue rising. It rose $200 billion so far. That's what just a war in Ukraine cost here, at least. So, okay, can you continue this? How? At what point does neoliberal fiscal policy crash? You know, at what point does the annual cost of interest rate become unsustainable? At what point can you no longer raise war and defense spending without totally exacerbating your deficit and debt here? How much can you cut austerity social programs? At some point, that trade-off is going to break, you see. Unlike monetary policy, neoliberal monetary policy, which is also already facing serious contradictions. Fiscal policy is an intermediate crisis. Monetary policy, neoliberal monetary policy, is an immediate crisis. That immediate crisis, you know, clearly is monetary policy is not working anymore. You know, it used to be, according to Economics 101, it used to be, well, you want to stimulate the economy, you just reduce interest rates, and that lowers the cost of investment and the buying of cars and houses, and it stimulates the spending and investment, right? Just lower the interest rates. Mm-hmm. And conversely or inversely, when you have inflation, you raise interest rates, and that dampens the economic growth and prevents runaway inflation. Now, that's what they still teach kids in college and macroecon 101. But it doesn't work that way, right? The reality is not that. It doesn't work. It's not very efficient. Monetary policy is not very efficient anymore. Efficient meaning lowering interest rates stimulates economic growth. No, it doesn't. Look at what's been happening here since the Great Recession. Well, they lowered interest rates, the Fed did, to zero, right? And they kept it there to like 2016, you know, 6-7 years. What did we get in terms of economic growth? Not very much. We got about 2/3 of what's normal recovering from recession. You know, in our prior recessions, the 2009-10 recession, we got very, very tepid, weak growth, about 2/3 of it, of normal. Right? And that, of course, adds to budget deficits, because when you don't have economic growth, you don't, robust economic growth, you don't collect as much tax revenue. That's, you know, in addition to the tax cuts. So, you know, we had a very weak growth. Zero interest rates for 6 years just did not stimulate economic growth the way it used to. Okay, now reverse that. We have this inflation, a lot of it supply side, and we got the Fed raising interest rates, right, to 5.5%, going higher now, right, at least two more rate hikes. It'll hit 6% here before the year is over. Right? Has that really shaken out inflation? Well, it's shaken out inflation in the goods sector. Yeah, goods prices, you know, physical things you buy, prices have come down. That's not driving inflation anymore. Construction, you know, prices are flat there, except, you know, for higher-end houses because of the lack of supply. Okay, but generally inflation is under control in the goods sector, which is manufacturing and construction. It's not under control in the core inflation, as they call it, the core meaning services. Services are chronically high, 5-6% on an annual basis, and it's been stuck at that for the last 6 months or so, despite the record Fed rate hikes. So rate hikes are not really working when it comes to the services sector. They're working in the goods sector, but not in the services sector, which means chronically high, which means the Fed is going to have to raise rates even higher if it wants to generate that unemployment and wage collapse that will reduce demand for services. Ah, but here's the problem with monetary policy. And once you get to 5-6%, it generates instability in the banking system, which we saw and is continuing since March, the regional banking collapse, right? Because interest rate risk, interest rate instability played a big role in that. Well, the Fed's answer to that was to throw money, more liquidity, as they call it, at the regional banks. How much? Over $1 trillion so far in just a couple months. Yeah, $1 trillion. $95 billion a week it was running. I don't know if it still is. Subsidy, money given to the regional banks to fill the black hole as people pull their deposits out of the regional banks and put it in the big banks, right? They got a contradiction there. Raising interest rates has to go higher to shake out services inflation, but as it goes higher, it stimulates more banking instability. And the patchwork they've done to contain that is the Fed throwing money at the regional banks. But what happens at the end of this year when the commercial real estate market, you know, what is that? That's malls, office buildings, amusement parks, right? Factories, so forth. That's the commercial real estate. What happens to commercial real estate at the end of the year, early next year, when it has to roll over, refinance, in other words, $1.7 trillion in debt, new debt, which is junk debt, right? The regional banks are heavily exposed to office buildings and malls. What happens? Will they roll over that debt, refinance that debt at a higher rate for investors who are already zombie companies? Well, what if these zombie companies in office buildings or whatever go broke? Well, then the regional banks have to put that debt on their balance sheet, and then they are in trouble, further trouble. Can the Fed continue to throw money at the regional banks at the rate it is when you have a commercial real estate bust that might occur by the end of the year? This is all part of the contradictions, you see, in monetary policy, neoliberal monetary policy. The Fed, to sum up, the Fed lowering rates does not generate a sufficient economic real growth as it used to. In other words, it's less efficient in lowering interest rates, and it's less efficient in raising rates to stop inflation than it was ever before. It has to raise rates even more. So it's inefficient in both directions, stimulating the economy and slowing the economy. That's the contradiction, because behind it all is the banking system, and they exacerbate the problems in the banking system when they try to deal with inflation or stimulate the economy. The Fed Chairman Powell said that, economic growth in last year was only 1%. From December to December. Forget these quarterly indications. Where are we in terms of GDP growth after a full year? 1% growth. And now he's forecasting only 1% this year in 23, and only 1% next year. The U.S. is growing, barely growing, at 1%. And that follows a massive Fed stimulus of $5 trillion in 2021, right? And then starting in March this year, another trillion. So the Fed has pumped like $6 trillion since COVID into the economy. And what have we gotten for it? 1% GDP. That's not counting $3 trillion in stimulus for households during COVID. And another $1.65 trillion for businesses now. Massive, massive, almost $10 trillion fiscal monetary stimulus, and what do we get for it? 1% GDP growth. That's the sign that there's a major problem in neoliberal fiscal monetary policy. A major, major problem. It's not working the way it used to work, whether that working means stimulating a slow economy or trying to recover from recession or trying to slow down an overheated economy. It's just not working anymore. Well, Biden comes along and he says, oh, Bidenomics, you know, is not trickle-down. Hell if it's not trickle-down. It's classic trickle-down. Because now all the money is going to these through these three acts and to the military-industrial complex, right? And those people, you know, absorb it. and very little gets to the rest of us. That's the essence of trickle-down. Trickle-down is a characteristic of neoliberal economics, and it's a characteristic of Bidenomics, no matter what they say the opposite. You see, what you got going here in Bidenomics and all this PR offensive is really ideology. It's really economic ideology. Let's digress and talk about that a little bit. What do we mean by ideology? Well, I don't mean some ism here, you know. That's one definition of ideology. What I mean is language manipulation. In other words, to misrepresent the truth, the facts, the reality in a way that allows them to engage in policies to benefit a certain small sector of interests, right? In other words, the capitalists, right? Corporations, the wealthy investors, and so forth, right? Ideology is manipulation of the truth, of facts, in order to justify policies that benefit special interests by manipulating language. Well, what do I mean, manipulating language? I wrote about this years ago. I haven't come back to this theme, but maybe I should. Language games, you know, in the philosopher Wittgenstein's definition of what a language game is, right? Well, that's what ideology is. It's manipulating language. For example, one technique for manipulating language is to reverse cause and effect between variables. In other words, to change concepts, to add concepts, to delete concepts from the original meaning, and to change that meaning, to change adding or deleting propositions. In other words, relationships between variables are a set of propositions. Concepts, propositions, right? You either delete those from the original meaning and change it to a new meaning, right? Or you add new concepts and propositions and their relationships, or you reverse cause and effect, or you insert new facts, new concepts, right? Or you universalize, you say something that existed for a certain time period is true forever, everywhere. These are techniques of language manipulation. That's what ideology in economics is about. I think the title of my article was Applications of Ideology in Economic Policy. I wrote this about the time of the Great Recession because it was obvious then. But ideology is really PR spin, right? It's propaganda, et cetera, right? Propaganda in economics, right? And that's what the Bidenomics PR offensive that's just being launched now for the election is really about. Yeah, it's really about that. It's ideology in economics. It's not economic science. And all of economics is part ideology and it's part science. You know, part of it is manipulation and misrepresentation of facts and the truth and reality. That's what meant here. And part of it is objective, empirical fact. And it's pretty hard sometimes for average folks to separate out the ideology from the science in economics. And that's why it's so useful to launch these PR approaches. And that's, of course, what's going on now. So to back up a little bit, I said that monetary policy is imminent contradiction, neoliberal, imminent. And it's a real problem for continuing neoliberalism. One of the themes being discussed is, you know, is neoliberalism in crisis? Well, with regard to that, I think neoliberal monetary policy is in immediate crisis. Neoliberal fiscal policy is in potential intermediate crisis. crisis. They can't continue with these deficits and war spending and tax cuts for corporations and austerity for the rest of us. And interest rates cost annually rising. At some point, that cannot be sustained. So that's like an intermediate problem. Neoliberal external trade dollar is also a policy crisis here, neoliberal crisis, as we've seen. The whole idea is to keep the dollar low, to benefit multinational corporations and their profit repatriation and exports and so forth. How is that faring? Is that in crisis? Yeah, that's in crisis too. Neoliberal external policy is in crisis. Why? Because of the policies of sanctions that have been launched here by this neocon-driven U.S. Imperial proxy war and trying to impose sanctions on the rest of the world, which isn't working, and really it's causing negative feedback by the rest of the world trying to get out from under the dollar. We got the de-dollarization trend going on because of these neoliberal geopolitical objectives going on, crisis here. So, the idea of a low dollar, a stable dollar, a dollar that's used for all commodities and energy and oil and basic trade across countries, that's breaking up, you see. That's breaking up slowly. It's just beginning, right? What we've got are countries coalescing around China and Russia and the BRICS, B-R-I-C, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, the BRICS, as they call them. They're expanding. More and more countries are petitioning to join the BRICS, to join China's Shanghai Cooperative Network, which is a free trade network, right? So the sanctions are back, backfiring here and causing trends towards de-dollarization and the use of growing explorations with the use of alternative currencies to the dollar, a lot more bilateral trade in their own currencies going on between countries that used to go on with dollars, and the talk about maybe the BRICS launching a kind of a currency here based on a basket of goods of their currencies and gold. That's being developed. A new international payment system is being explored, getting out from under the U.S. SWIFT. That's an acronym, International Payment System, by the way, which allows the U.S. through the banking system to see who's violating sanctions. If you're not using SWIFT, if you're using some other alternative, then the U.S. can't see who's using who's violating the sanctions, you see. But that's developing as well. Talk of alternatives to the IMF, International Monetary Fund, which is a U.S.-based controlled World Bank, same thing, U.S.-based controlled, right? A bifurcation of global trade that's beginning to occur. The U.S. is circling the wagons with its G7 allies here, and the rest of the world is looking for ways maybe to play, the G7 against Russia, China, and the BRICS, or joining the BRICS, or playing both, right? But a bifurcation of trade going on. The dollar is chronically high here because of interest rates going up, right? It means the dollar rises, and, of course, if the dollar rises, U.S. multinational corporations can only buy fewer dollars when they try to repatriate it, right? Rising dollar also puts pressure on foreign countries' currencies, causes those currencies to depreciate, which causes other problems with those countries of buying imports and goods, whether it's food or medical or whatever. And they have to raise their interest rates, which slows their economy. That's one reason why the global economy is slowing, because the dollar is chronically high and now rising in relationship to, tied very closely to, rising interest rates. So it destabilizes global currencies, and that's what's going on, and slows the global economy, and that's what's going on as well. And then we have the Biden tech war against China. That's part of external policy. You know, under Trump, Trump attempted to slow technology development in China using tariffs. Didn't work. Total failure. He couldn't do it. And now we have a more aggressive form of a tech war with China under the Biden administration, you know, quotas and embargoes and boycotts and driving Chinese corporations and businesses out of the U.S. and its allies' economies to the extent they can. And China now responding and putting pressure on U.S. companies in China, you know, responding to the pressure. And it's ironic, you get... Janet Yellen, Treasury, and some of the others really complaining about, oh, China is putting pressure on U.S. companies, you know, restrictions on U.S. companies. Well, what do you expect with this full-blown offensive against Chinese companies by the U.S.? They're just responding. But it's it's an indication of the instability in this area of neoliberal policy, external policy, right? Even problems with Europe here in terms of trade. The subsidy bills that Biden has passed is causing a lot of heartburn for the Europeans, because it means their businesses are leaving Europe and building new production expansion in the U.S. rather than in Europe. Right? And then we have the U.S. With its sanctions driving Russia out of Western Europe energy market, and in general out of Western Europe, so the U.S. can sell natural gas and oil at a higher price than the Russians were to the Europeans. That's what's going on now. And the Europeans, of course, going along with it because they're just now an economic satrapy of the United States capitalist economy here, and increasingly so. You know, if you look at external policy, whether it's dollar policy, whether it's trade and goods, right, whether it's currency policy, whatever flows of money flows and so forth, this area of neoliberalism is also facing growing contradictions and problems. I would say that monetary policy is in an immediate contradiction and problem. Neoliberal monetary policy. Fiscal policy is an intermediate crisis of fiscal policy, neoliberal. And external trade policy, also growing crisis here as the economy gets bifurcated, the global economy gets bifurcated here increasingly. Now, why do we have all these problems here in neoliberal policy in the external sector? It's because U.S. capitalism has been evolving towards, quote, financialization and globalization. It's ultimately financialization and globalization that is underlying some of these problems or contributing to some of these problems. But financialization, particularly global financialization, has been very profitable for U.S. capitalists, and they like it. But it causes them problems, overlaid now the geopolitical neocon war policies is exacerbating all this. Three areas of neoliberal policy are in trouble at different stages. What about industrial policy? Well, that's working quite well. Neoliberal industrial policy under Biden is working quite well. What is that? Well, that is to keep wages down, to keep unions weak, to reduce benefits at the company level for workers, the cost of benefits. Don't raise minimum wages, right? Don't bring out the labor law reform, like the PRO Act, and before that under Obama, Card Check Act, right? And when workers in key industries look like they're going to strike because they're desperate, bring the full power of the state and the legal system down on their backs. We saw that with the railroad workers, right, under Biden here, threatening anti-strike legislation here, maybe even, you know, seizing some of the company. Who knows what that would have been? The railroad workers, you know, who only wanted 7 days paid sick leave, got leaned on pretty heavily by the Biden administration. It shows you that, Biden, I'm the most pro-union president. You know, bullshit. All I can say, bullshit. That's all that is. Because he's one of the most anti-labor presidents. As we saw with the railroad workers, as we saw with minimum wages, you know, the first meeting he had when he came into office was with a couple dozen corporate CEOs, and he promised them there would be no minimum wage hike in my administration. The first thing he did, the first meeting he had in 2021, in January still, coming into office, after he promised to raise minimum wages, you know, what a broken promises. Politicians tell you what you want to hear, and then once they get you voted, do what the hell they want. And usually that's what their campaign benefactors want. You know, real wages have been contracting dramatically here in the U.S. Minimum wage is not rising. No labor law reform. When workers get uppity, the state steps in. In terms of benefits, you know, no public option for Medicare. COVID relief subsidies were cut prematurely. Supplemental unemployment benefits were cut prematurely, right? 401k pensions, which benefit corporations, not workers so much, were given a boost here, while real pensions were allowed to atrophy even further, right? This is all industrial policy. It's all been very successful. There's no contradiction or crisis going on in neoliberal industrial policy, especially under Biden. Industrial policy means also privatization and deregulation. Well, that's continuing, right? Despite this crisis in the regional banks, there's been no re-regulation. You know, they were exempted from the Dodd-Frank bill in 2017, and despite the fact there's a crisis, there's no talk about re-regulating these regional banks. So that's going on. There's a lot of selling off of assets, government public goods and assets to the private sector, deregulation, privatization. That's going on. Corporate price gouging, nothing's being done about that. There's no antitrust occurring at all in the U.S. You know, and the federal stress tests are phony stress tests even for the big banks here. So industrial policy, neoliberal, has been quite successful. There's no contradiction there, and it's been continuing on steroids under Biden. So you sum up neoliberal policies here, as I've just said, these four areas, and you got three areas in different degrees of growing crisis. One area, industrial policy, not. We'll see what happens when the Teamsters strike UPS here next month. Watch the Biden administration come down on them, too. Yet we get this Bidenomic spin, which is just ideology. Okay, I'm out of here.